B-Cure Laser is now available in the UK. To get your very special offer right now, just call 0808 501 5122.
This is the Oncozine Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofflin.
In this edition of the Oncozine Brief, I'm talking with Peter Keeling about personalized medicine, diagnostic testing, and the effect of COVID-19 on cancer and cancer diagnostics. We also talk about the world's first diagnostic network for precision medicine. Peter Keeling is the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Diaceutics. Since its founding, the company has built the world's largest repository of diagnostic testing data with a growing network of 2,500 laboratories in 51 countries. The company recently launched the world's first digital diagnostics platform solution. Diaceutics has launched this new platform called the Diagnostic Network to help solve the many problems that exist today within the patient's diagnosis process. A proper diagnostic test is an essential step to ensure that the patient receives the most efficient treatment. Correctly diagnosing also leads to effectively managing a patient's disease, which in turn results in improved healthcare outcomes. In contrast, the failure to diagnose a condition correctly can reduce the possibility of a good healthcare outcome and limit a patient's ability to fully recover. Diaceutics Network has been designed to accelerate the end-to-end development and commercialization of precision medicine diagnostics. But more importantly, the platform is designed to get every patient the treatment he or she deserves. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncozine Brief. The Oncozine Brief is developed in collaboration with our online journal, Oncozine, at www.oncozine.com, where you can find additional information and the latest news about cancer, cancer diagnosis and treatment, and cancer prevention. For more information about supporting the Oncozine Brief, go to Oncozine at www.oncozine, and it's spelled oncozine.com. If you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word CANCER to 66866, and we will make sure that you will receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology. With me on the phone is Peter Keeling. Peter is the founder and chief executive officer of Diaceutics, a company he started in 2005, and it's a company dealing with or primarily focusing on personalized medicine. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for hosting me.
COVID is a word that has everybody kind of made a little bit scared around the world. It's also some of the things that when you look at personalized medicine, in which you're involved, or medicine in general, you're involved, it has an impact. But first of all, how are you and your coworkers around the world coping with COVID? Are you guys are okay?
We're good, Peter. Thank you for asking. One of the things I will say about the Diaceutics model was that as an organization, we set up 15 years ago to be, I would say, kind of quasi-virtually located. So our teams have always been very familiar with working from a home environment. We do have obviously headquarters and various offices around the world, but by and large, people are close to the labs and the pharmaceutical industries that we work with. So the first observation we made earlier in the year was that as kind of the first wave and subsequent ripples occurred, that our team were pretty comfortable kind of working from that home environment. So there wasn't so much disruption. Clearly, in each of, you know, we have people in 17 different countries now. And as we've sort of observed from the team that in our team in China, based out of Singapore, Taiwan, Korea, where we listened to them very early in December last year, going into what was their version of lockdowns, all the way through to Italy, where we have, three or four people in Italy, and then subsequently the UK, and of course, eventually over to the US. So we sort of listened across the team and we kind of observed how COVID has worked across the world. But by and large, the team as well, one or two of our team members have fallen ill. Thankfully, they've managed through it. and some of their family members also have fallen in, but thankfully they've managed through it. And, you know, being in healthcare, you're always super sensitive to mask wearing and, you know, the basic hygiene and things like that. And one interesting note is that a couple of my team members, well, several of my team members are themselves out, you know, are from the laboratory environment and were asked on a kind of voluntary basis to step back in to be frontline staff. And of course, as an organization in healthcare, you know, our responsibility was to serve that. And, you know, we released them for periods of time to do that. And, you know, again, good tales of how they've been on the front line. So a good sort of mix of response. Thankfully, we're all well. The business is healthy and, you know, we're getting on with it.
Well, that is definitely good news. I mean, I'm happy that you'd be able to kind of cope with that, that your coworkers are doing well and that the company is doing well. Now, talking about the company, I mentioned in the introduction, you started the company about 15 years ago in 2005. What made you do this? What was your background in what made you think, well, this is some of the things that I really want to focus on? Of course, it is about precision medicine and precision medicine in the diagnostic space. So what were some of the key things for you to say, there is something that's not, I like to do that, is something that is not there yet. And let me work this out.
I'll hop very quickly over my early career. You know, the first kind of 11, 12 years of my career, I've been in healthcare now for some 34 years. The first kind of 11, 12 years, I was in the pharmaceutical industry. So I saw how it operated. I understood the model and in so many ways admire the kind of the ability of a pharmaceutical industry to change diseases. And I was fortunate enough in my career to have lived through the launch. And we were responsible for the launch of the very first HIV drugs and watched the market reaction to all of that. It was a very profound moment in early kind of pharmaceutical history. I left that, it was GlaxoSmithKline, I left that company after about 12 years. And I kind of took my gap year. I was, you know, some 34 years of age at that stage. But I took my gap year and I spent a year at MIT in Boston. And literally the concept behind what we're doing today was born there. And it was simply this, was that I spent my time pulling together a think tank of individuals, which you can do in that, you know, academic environment. I was a visiting fellow at the Sloan School. And I had, you know, folks from the New England Medical Center. There were folks from the FDA. There were thinkers from Harvard. And we pulled them together into a kind of a series of what is the future of healthcare and where are the big wins in terms of changing healthcare. And like a couple of those ideas were things that were, you know, were interesting, like the redesign of clinical trials, the Bayesian design of clinical trials, things that have actually come true. But one of the areas that intrigued me the most was this concept that patient testing and diagnosis was an orphan in terms of the kind of the healthcare paradigm. You know, the dollars and the money and the attention flows to treatment, appropriately so in many instances. But yet, so many of these of patients' healthcare is defined by their speed at which they travel towards that treatment. For some, that we now know on our data. For some, that's relatively quick. A relatively small percentage of patients in cancer, for example, will get the right testing regime, less than 10%. But the vast majority have a very protracted and emotional roller coaster through diagnostic testing. Now, once that data wasn't evident to me way back in kind of 1994, 1995, the various hints, the mood music was that there seems to be something in healthcare where better testing and better diagnosis management could have an equal or greater opportunity to change people's healthcare. Now, one comes out of that type of a think tank environment, which I did after a year, and think, well, what am I going to do with that information? And actually what I did was I started a diagnostic company thinking, well, this is the right way to approach this. And I it was in a diagnostic company in sexually transmitted diseases. And I ran it for 7 years. It was venture capital backed. Obviously, one learns a lot about starting a business, topic for another day. But what intrigued me the most was that I was able to observe at a kind of a 100 feet level how badly the diagnostic ecosystem was managed. And whilst we have wonderful technologies, and that was true then, and it's even more true today, the adoption of those technologies, the embedding of those technologies in clinical guidelines, and most importantly, patient access to those technologies is limited not by the fault of the technology, but by the fault of the fact of a system that operates in silos. And so whilst I was trying to run a business in diagnostic testing, and I was doing all the things that you do as a businessman, at the same time, I was observing the dysfunction. And I used to have what I called, oh my God, days. And, you know, I had come out of the pharmaceutical industry. So, I you have a sense of when something's not working, you can invest in moving that. And of course, you can't do that in diagnostics because the margins are so thin. Labs make very little money. Diagnostic companies don't make a huge amount of money. The most valuable diagnostic, and obviously today we have things like Foundation Medicine and Guardant, but you know, the most valuable diagnostic up until recently had a revenue of $40 million. That's the most valuable diagnostic in the United States market. Compare and contrast with a therapy which might have, you know, $4 billion or $5 billion.
Let's take a break. And then we're back with Peter Keeling, the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Diaceutics.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is encouraging cancer patients and survivors to be extra cautious during the COVID-19 pandemic. Cancer treatment, especially chemotherapy, weakens the immune system, making you at higher risk of severe illness. Dr. Lisa Richardson is director of the CDC's Division of Cancer Prevention and Control.
Take these steps to stay healthy. Wash your hands often with soap and water. Clean and disinfect frequently touched surfaces daily. Stay home. If you must leave, keep at least 6 feet between you and others. Avoid touching your face, eyes, nose, and mouth with unwashed hands. If your temperature is 100.4 or higher, call your doctor. Use CDC's coronavirus self-checker to help you make decisions about seeking medical care.
Make sure your caregivers and household members are aware of your higher risk and take precautions. Visit cdc.gov/coronavirus and preventcancerinfections.org for more health tips.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofflin.
If you're just joining us, this week I'm talking with Peter Keeling, the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Diaceutics. The company has worked on every kind of precision medicine brought to market and provides services to 36 of the world's leading pharmaceutical companies. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
So you can see that it's very much the poor relation. What I felt at that time was I started to understand what was broken through the lens of that original company. Now, as happens in startups, you know, we ran it. I ran that company during the dot-com boom, which meant that if you didn't have dot-com on your name, there wasn't a lot of money. And so we ran out of money. It was a company based out of Cary in North Carolina. But I took a step back and I said, what have I learned here? I've learned that the pharmaceutical industry has the ability to change a disease. I've learned that there is something within the diagnostic pathway which has the ability to change patients and treatment outcomes. And I've learned the hard way that diagnostic management and the management of that diagnostic pathway is something that's particularly broken. And if I piece that all back together again, what does this need to look like as a disruptive approach back into the market? And that's what gave birth to Diaceutics. And if I may just follow that rabbit for a second, I thought maybe the way to approach this is to put together an approach back to the pharmaceutical industry and say, kind of, you're living in the wealthy real estate here. You are the ones that should be investing in the poor neighborhood next door. Now, at the time, precision medicine was actually a whisper. It was a niche. And so this was not an approach into precision medicine. It was merely an approach into how do I get the pharmaceutical industry involved in the diagnostic pathways of patients. And I happened to put together what was a return on investment model I presented it at a meeting in Orlando back in 2005. Amusingly, I was offered the last slot on the last day of a pharma conference, and I realized I was competing with SeaWorld and Mickey Mouse. But nonetheless, I was able to hold on. You know, I started with 50 people in the room. In the end, I had seven. And you'll have been there, Peter. You're very crestfallen about those moments. But serendipity played a part. Yeah. Two people in that room, one from AstraZeneca and one from Glaxo, walked up to me and said, "You have just explained to us how, by investing more in the way these patients are being managed in terms of their diagnostic testing, we will have a better treatment outcome." And I said, "Well, it's a hypothesis." That's all it was. That's all it was. It was a hypothesis. And that hypothesis thing is, if you invest in this, then you will get more patients on treatment. It's good for you as an industry. It's good for the patient. It's good for the regulators. And they said, "Look, this is an intriguing idea. Can you operationalize this?" And of course, you know, like all good entrepreneurs at the time, you tell a little white lie and you say, "Yeah, we have guys." Well, of course, there were no guys. The business card was barely dry. But nonetheless, I was able to pull together a team of people, and we worked with GlaxoSmithKline on three therapies, one HIV, one prostate cancer, and one Alzheimer's. And we worked with AstraZeneca on two cancer drugs. And right. And from that very, very early experience, I started to learn not the language of diagnostics or the language of disruption, because I'd sort of covered that. I learned the language of how do you get a pharmaceutical company at a very project level to understand that this is good for them to really engage in that diagnostic pathway. And so I have a very long-winded explanation, Peter, but it's an interesting journey. And it just so happened that at that moment in time, we're talking 2005, 2006, and you'll remember this, and many of your listeners will remember this, we were watching the very first kind of successes with Herceptin and Erbitux and Tasigna. And these were the drugs that were starting to create a paradigm shift. And so I was coming along talking about diagnostic pathways and diagnostic journeys. And all of a sudden, there were a series of drugs that are now totally dependent upon those same diagnostic pathways.
And that was also probably the first really inroads with what we now call personalized or companion diagnostics, with some of the drugs that really were so targeted at one particular time after this phase, that they were only be useful in patients who were carrying the characteristics to be receiving this drug. So companion diagnostics, FDA is now making it mandatory for a lot of different drugs, but that was unheard of if you go back 10, 15 years ago, I guess.
You know, we were sent back in those early days, there were a handful of therapies. Some kind of, you know, the research and development really engine of pharma was just beginning to understand biomarker guided medicine. But credit to those early R&D teams, they realized very quickly that although on one level you were theoretically reducing the market target for that drug, you know, you're now looking for 17% of the population because the drug will only work in that population. What you're being rewarded with is significantly greater outcomes. And ultimately, yeah, that's a win-win for everybody. And I think what has happened subsequent to those early experiments is that the pharmaceutical R&D, particularly in cancer, but increasingly in other areas, are saying this is good. This is good because not only are we able to bring these drugs to market faster with more elegant clinical trials, but we're actually being able to deliver value back into the healthcare market because we're targeting very specific patients, and we're making sure that they get onto these drugs, that we're making sure that they are the right patients for that drug. So it has proven to be a significant success, and we've seen what I would describe as a tsunami of therapies moving into clinical trials, some 400 plus moving into clinical trials over the last 10 years. And I think that, if anything, speaks to the fact that we're not really looking at the minute as precision medicine being a niche anymore, but rather being the predominant model, certainly within oncology, probably within autoimmune disease, maybe within cardiovascular disease, and possibly within central nervous system disease. So I think we're observing that unfold in front of us.
It is definitely interesting to see that it's still not there yet, but that more and more patients can expect to be treated as the individual, really focused on their individual needs, that meeting their individual expectations, not only in the way the doctor talks to you or the doctor and the nursing staff is dealing with you, but really also in the treatment that they need to receive. And that is, I think, it's a positive thing. It makes healthcare in the United States also a little bit more expensive. But in the end, it is definitely something that is good for the patients. Talking about good for patients, we've seen going back to today and going back to COVID, what we've seen here in the United States is that as a result of COVID, a lot of research, a lot of diagnostics, a lot of testing has basically shifted from other therapeutic areas, from cardiovascular to current cancer to whatever forms of diagnostics that were required early on, which is always the best way to do, has moved to COVID. Now, I know that you have been involved in some testing in China, where you looked at the effect of COVID had on, for example, cancer diagnostics. You looked at, I think, also in the United States, what the effect was of COVID diagnostics and the testings in those areas, what kind of effect that has on cancer. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely, and you're correct. So we use China, A, because the breadth of our organization allows us to look and compare markets. So we had a team based out of Shanghai and working in China, looking at the very early response and the impact of COVID testing on other types of testing, particularly cancer. And we were then able to compare and contrast with what we were observing early in April and May in the United States. And there are very strong parallels. But the big picture is that as the demands for COVID testing arrived, labs and laboratories were understandably distracted. Now, an infectious disease lab and a cancer lab are often not the same, and they're not even necessarily in the same buildings. But the staffing of that, you were kind of hoovering up or sucking in staffing from cancer labs into COVID testing labs. Now, that's still a work in progress. You know, in the United States, we're up around a million COVID tests today. Some of the projections are saying that if we really are going to manage this disease, that needs to rise fivefold. So that journey of distraction has not finished yet. And whilst we're several months into this and there's a little bit more understanding of laboratory bandwidth, if you can put it that way, there will still be a stress on the laboratory system for COVID from some time to come.
Let's take a break, and then we're back with our interview with Peter Keeling. Peter Keeling is the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Diaceutics. The company has worked on every kind of precision medicine brought to market and provides services to 36 of the world's leading pharmaceutical companies. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is The Oncogene Brief.
Clinical trials allow researchers to introduce new hope by providing participants access to cutting-edge and potentially life-saving treatments. Speak with your doctor and visit standuptocancer.org/clinicaltrials to learn more. Together, we can stand up for all of us.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofland.
And welcome back. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
The second impact that we saw in China and now in the United States is that testing is a very early indicator of what patient behavior is. And what we could see in cancer was that the cancer patients weren't presenting to the hospitals and to their clinicians in China and again in the United States. Pretty obvious, you know, people worry about going to the hospital to get the testing, routine testing. And indeed, there were professional bodies who were saying, you know, if you can, stay away. Well, the consequence of that was profound in terms of numbers. Some 20 to 30% of patients in some of these cancers stayed away. And it was having an impact in two patient types, Peter. The first were what we would describe as the kind of the undiagnosed, the ones who were at the very beginning of their diagnostic journey. Perhaps they were going for an x-ray, perhaps there was a cough, perhaps there was a pain, something that they otherwise would have presented for that might have been triaged ultimately into the cancer, pathway. And others who were due to get their biomarker testing, well, you know, they were maybe pre-treatment. And what we saw there was that those who were ready to have their diagnostic test run or their molecular test done and to go on to treatment were probably unaffected. But those that were maybe within the next couple of months to become candidates for that type of testing, those patients dropped away. And so what we've been able to do is to look, compare and contrast in those two countries and track what is happening. And our sense is, and this is a work in progress, our sense is as we look, as we get the evidence of what has happened in June, July, and August in the United States, and that data is starting to come through to us, and we'll start to get a sense of how many patients have actually not presented into the system. Well, of course, those patients didn't go away. We possibly can start to model what is the impact of what I've called is the COVID's third wave, not an infectious disease third wave, but the disease sequelae and the consequences of not testing, whether it be cancer patients and indeed other diseases. And so our sense is, and we're forming a hypothesis around this with our opinion leaders, with our laboratorians, is that what we're likely to see in March, April, and May of next year is a demand, a surge, if you like, of patients who are now presenting with maybe different symptomology, or they're patients who are presenting because they were worried that they didn't get tested. At the very same time that the demand for COVID testing will be increasing and therefore putting pressure on the system. So we're concerned about a perfect storm of events occurring, which is impacting, you know, in our lens as cancer patients here, but it has consequences beyond that. Throw into that one other kind of little observation, and is that it would appear coming through the clinical literature that a patient who has cancer and who then goes on to have COVID will have worse cancer. And so what we now need to look at is what is the testing regime for those patients, and should that be more enriched? And so there's a lot of work to do as a result of COVID. And even as COVID passes, and hopefully we'll get the vaccines, and hopefully we will start to manage this process from the pandemic appropriately, we will have to turn our eyes towards all the consequences of those patients, again, whose diagnostic journey and subsequently their treatment journey has been impacted.
In some cancers, having maybe a week, 2 weeks, maybe even a month postponement of diagnostics may not necessarily have a major impact. Some cancers, it is absolutely important that they're being diagnosed and being go in treatment immediately. But if you look at the whole landscape right now, is your expectations that come early next year, a lot of the diagnostics has been postponed or delayed, that we will see an increase in more serious forms of cancer?
Yes, I think that's inevitable. And again, others, our own team within Diaceutics and others, I think are speaking to this. It's a natural consequence of delayed diagnosis in cancer. And, you know, we know, ever take any one of these, and let's look at lung cancer. So a lot of these pre-COVID times, a lung cancer patient typically, and you'll know there's no such thing as a typical patient, but at a population level, a lung cancer patient will travel something like 4 years from cough to targeted drug. And there may be other interventions along the way. But if you then saying is that journey has been postponed by a further 6 months, then you've really catching those patients not at stage 3 cancer, but at stage 4 cancer. And the potential outcomes as a result of that are significantly poorer. So it is consequential what is happening here. And I think, you know, hopefully the political wherewithal and the healthcare system wherewithal will quickly move its eyes not just towards how do we manage COVID, but how do we manage the consequences of COVID and these other diseases.
Yeah, because, I mean, early in the year, I had an interview with somebody who mentioned the fact that COVID is an additional burden to the disease management. when COVID hit, it did not mean that other forms of disease, whether it's cancer or cardiovascular or anything else, were going away. I mean, we still, it's an added burden to the healthcare system. So to cope with that is definitely some of the things that we have to think about right now. In testing, and it's kind of interesting thing in some reading some materials that were published by your company, one of the things that struck is that in non-small lung cancer, there may be a situation where about 10% of the patients who receive treatment receive that without relevant testing. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think this is the value. This is the value of the real world data. And Peter, I one of the things, if I go back those 15 years, I mentioned the meeting back in Orlando 15 years ago, we were hypothesizing about a lot of this. I think time has moved on, and we're able to see now through laboratory testing data and claims data, et cetera, and studies, that we now have the sufficient evidence to say is what exactly really is happening to these patients, not in a clinical trial setting, which is very artificial, but in the real world. And what we can see is that there are all sorts of what I would describe as missed practices. Now, the missed practices are that often a patient might present as a candidate for a drug, and there's an urgency attached to that. And the physician, whether it be pressure from the patient or whether it be, you know, a last resort approach, that patient will proceed on to that therapy. And what we can see in our data is that those patients have not gone through the prerequisite testing. 10% is an average across cancers. In some cancers, it's greater than others. And, you know, one would say as well, is that really important? The patient went on and got the treatment anyway. Well, it may be, because a lot of these therapies are particularly the newer ones, are particularly expensive. But from a patient's point of view, when you put a patient on a treatment that is not appropriate for that patient, you are presumably denying them or delaying their ability to move on a treatment that's more important, more appropriate. So we do think that's a gap that needs to be closed. And whilst I'm sure every one of those circumstances and decisions to put that patient on a treatment without the appropriate test may have been taken in the interest of that individual patient, I think at a population level, I think this is something that we need to revisit and look at. And again, using that same data, you can look right across, whether it be lung cancer or colon cancer or breast cancer, and say, where are the other missed opportunities to test these patients appropriately or to introduce tests that they're currently not being introduced to? And our real-world data shows us lots of time that there are missed opportunities. And the good thing about medicine is that somebody somewhere is probably experimenting with doing the right thing, but they're maybe not integrating that with the next right thing. So our data also shows where there's good practice. And I think part of our sense is that what we need to do is to spread that good practice out much more quickly in precision testing and precision medicine than is currently happening.
Well, it's interesting to look at, because of course there are different aspects to that. I mean, when you look at some diagnostic tests and the willingness of patients to participate, I think if you look at colorectal cancer is one example where patients are hesitant to do that, or there are a lot of myths built around the need for diagnostic testing, even in a preventative state, while there is no cancer, and then take it further if there is something that's being diagnosed. So that is an interesting thing, that there are a lot of things at play that may influence the outcomes in that respect. But it's of course a good thing to look at the new diagnostics networks that may be developing. And talking about diagnostic networks, it's some of the things that you are developing with global partners to fix those cancer testing issues. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, and again, you know, I've alluded to the fact that we started this journey at Diaceutics 15 years ago. In some ways, it has gone past in a heartbeat. In others, it has been a long journey of trying to understand what is the right way to fix this. And if we assume that our data and other published data are telling us that the ecosystem, i.e. the way in which these patients are traveling to this treatment, that diagnostic ecosystem is broken, how do you fix an ecosystem? And, you know, whilst we have partnered multiple times with the pharmaceutical industry and multiple times with laboratories and some of the great laboratories across the globe, to a certain extent, we're all still operating in our various silos.
Let's take a break, and then we're back with our interview with Peter Keeling. Peter Keeling is the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Diaceutics. The company has worked on every kind of precision medicine brought to market and provides services to 36 of the world's leading pharmaceutical companies. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
Sarcoma. Odds are you've never heard that word before. But for the 40 people diagnosed with sarcoma every day, it is a life-changing word. Life-changing and devastating because sarcoma is cancer. Sarcoma is a cancer of bone and soft tissue more prevalent in children than in adults. More than 6,000 people lose their lives to sarcoma each year. Treatment options for sarcoma are limited and new therapies are desperately needed. More research and increased awareness is necessary to find a cure for a cancer that you probably didn't even know existed until now. Through awareness, advocacy, and research, the Sarcoma Foundation of America is determined to help those affected by this forgotten cancer, to bring hope to the children and adults whose lives are forever changed by a word they had never heard before. Please help us in the fight to find the cure for sarcoma. For more information on sarcoma and the work of the Sarcoma Foundation of America, please go to curesarcoma.org.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofland.
If you're just joining us, this week I'm talking with Peter Keeling, the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Diaceutics. The company has worked on every kind of precision medicine brought to market and provides services to 36 of the world's leading pharmaceutical companies. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
And so what we conceived 3 or 4 years ago was to say, is this a situation where we need to introduce a platform? And, you know, platform business models are evident in other parts of our world in terms of the financial sector, in terms of travel and all of these various things. So we are familiar with the power of platforms to transform business areas. But it's always been a struggle in healthcare. And the reason it's a struggle in healthcare is that you have to win the trust, the hearts and minds of the various participants who, by definition, because it's healthcare, are incredibly conservative. So we were in an advantage there because we had kind of 10 years, 12 years behind us of building those relationships with the top 30 pharmaceutical companies with over 2,500 labs across the globe. We sat back and said, what would it look like if we could bring all those people together to collaborate together before the arrival of a diagnostic, or to fix a diagnostic that was broken, or a patient journey that was broken? And as we architected that, we recognized that we were in a very powerful position with the data that we had gathered over, now almost 400 million patient journeys. We really had the evidence to show how, what, where, and when to create the change. What we needed to do was to create a platform which allowed that level of collaboration in a safe, secure way. And so what we've brought to the market in recent days is a platform which we call DXRX. The two abbreviations that are most familiar with diagnostic and treatment. And we deliberately chosen to say these worlds have to come together and they have to work together, have to function together. And what we've done is to create a space, a marketplace, if you like, that has broadly two functioning areas. The first is we're giving access to the full suite of data that we have. You want to know what's happening with lung cancer in Germany? Here is the data. You can see it for yourself. You want to know what's happening with lung cancer in Arizona? Here is the data. You can see that. You want to know how that physician is managing their diagnostic journey? Here is the data to show that. So very granular way of looking at that information. And now what you can do with the other part of our platform is says, okay, let us create a mechanism for safe collaboration around fixing that, whether it be a problem of reimbursement for an individual test or whether it be a problem of quality testing in breast cancer. And what we've conceived, and we've designed this in conjunction with our pharma clients and our laboratory partners, is what do you need from a platform that makes sure that you will come together and collaborate safely? And so what we've designed is a platform that does those two things. Provides the information to show where you need to create the change and provides the safe level of collaboration to create those changes. And we've already launched, you know, three or four of those collaborations, and we did that prior to the platform being released yesterday, the reason being for demand. And we anticipate that we will have multiple collaborations on an ongoing basis. And these collaborations will open, they'll look at a problem, they'll solve the problem, they'll close, they'll move on, and we'll be able to use our data to track the progress there. So it's functioning as a proper kind of ecosystem, kind of a glue within the ecosystem. And of course, its success will be determined by, can we get, you know, all the right collaborators around the table. And we're supported by, I think, some of the greatest, you know, key opinion leaders at the minute, people like Marcus Epstein and Ken Bloom. These are names that others will be familiar with in the cancer space. People who have looked at what we've done, and we've collaborated with them and said, is this what the system needs? And they've said, this is exactly what we need. We need this level of kind of integrated thinking to bring us together in a safe environment and allow us to collaborate together. And I think that's the journey that we started with the platform.
Yeah, now you mentioned, and actually at different points in the interview, you mentioned something about the silos that actually are make it very hard to collaborate. You mentioned the pharma industry maybe on one side, you mentioned diagnostics on the other side. But obviously, the silos that are there, there are multiple silos. So in developing this collaborative platform, which silos did you have to try to open up or to kind of pull together to have them work together, to collaborate?
What I'm about to say is this is the beginning. But I think the beginning, what we felt were there were three groups that we felt had the greatest kind of industrial, if I can put it as a kind of the industrial business model capability to create the change. The pharmaceutical industry, because they're launching the drugs, which are test dependent. So they're driven towards trying to fix this with new tests coming in and indeed existing tests that they need to improve. So their motivations were high. The second group were the laboratories. Now, we've always characterized the laboratories as the forgotten stakeholder. Yet, when you consider that they are the front line of changing the way patients are being tested, yet they are working off often very, very, you know, small margins, their ability to invest in education is always challenged. And we've put our arms around that community, and it is a community, of passionate professionals who really want to make a difference for those patients. We have yet to come across a laboratory that doesn't want to do better testing and do more accurate testing. And so they are driven to saying is, give us the information, show us where we're going wrong, help us knock down some of these barriers. I mean, they're being asked to introduce tests, often given 4 months' notice to introduce a test for which they're not even being reimbursed. And they try their best to do it, but it's a struggle. What we're looking at is, well, let's bring that information back to the pharmaceutical industry, who have the ability to invest in removing some of those hurdles. And then the third triangle there were the diagnostic companies themselves, who clearly have, you know, new exciting technologies that they can bring to bear. Now, one thing we do know is that in cancer testing, only a third, broadly a third of patients will ever get tested with those new novel diagnostic technologies. The majority of the time, the labs will develop their own variant of that test. So we must have both of those players at the table. The diagnostic companies, because they're innovative and unique, and they're working with the regulators, and the labs, because they're trying to do the right thing. However, I don't think that's where we should stop. If what we have worked through in 2021 is to have those three groups collaborating, then I think what we need to start to look at is how we can bring the payers into the table, how we can bring the patient advocates into the table. And we've already started to reach out to those groups and say, what is your lens on this? Surely you have a benefit of participating in this ecosystem too. And finally, will be the patients themselves. And, you know, I remember at a conference 10 years ago, 12 years ago, with a man called Rick Carlson, you may have met him on your journey, Peter, who said, ultimately, precision medicine belongs to the patient and the patient will drive this. And that's always stuck in my mind. And I think of this in terms of the diagnostic journey. Most patients' diagnostic journey seems very remote. It's managed by third parties. They abdicate responsibility for that. But yet, we live in a world where you know, we now control our own banking. We're now controlling lots of aspects of our healthcare through aspects of our lives through technology. And so our sense is by building a system, an ecosystem, which is working towards giving that patient's diagnostic journey a higher chance of success and speed all the way through, ultimately, we need to think about how we're going to bring the patient into that. Now, and that might be 2 or 3 years away, 4 years away, I don't know. But I do feel that the patient ultimately will have a role in driving forward this type of platform play.
I must say that at the end of our show today, that is actually a perfect conclusion of where we are ending up with. It's with the patient and actually the important role that the patient plays in this. Peter, thank you very much for your time today. We love to hear more in the future about what your company, what you're doing with your company, Diaceutics, what you do with the new platform that you're building. It's all very exciting, and hopefully we see some very positive results coming up in the very near future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Peter. Thank you.
In today's edition of the Oncogene Brief, I spoke with Peter Keeling, the Chief Executive Officer and Founder of Diaceutics. For more information about the company and the world's first digital diagnostic platform solution launched by the company, visit Diaceutics' website at diaceutics.com. For us here at the Oncogene Brief, we want to thank you, our listeners, sponsors, and advertisers, for your ongoing support. Your support makes it possible that you can hear this program via PRX, Public Radio Exchange, and in the United Kingdom and mainland Europe via UK Health Radio. And you can also download our program via podcast and streaming media, including iTunes and Spotify. For more information about supporting the Oncogene Brief, go to Oncogene at www.oncogene.com. If you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer to 66866, and we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology. Thank you all, and thank you for listening. And join us again for our next episode. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
The Oncogene Brief is produced for Sun Valley Communication by Peter Hofland, Sonia Portillo, Evan Wendt, David Kaler, and distributed by InPress Media Group. Support for the Oncogene Brief comes from listeners of this station and our commercial underwriters and advertisers. For more information about underwriting and sponsoring options, visit our website at oncogene.com/underwriting. The Oncogene Brief contains health and medicine-related information and is provided for educational and entertainment purposes only. The content is not intended as a substitute for professional medical or health advice and does not replace your doctor's advice. Your doctor is the best person to answer questions about your personal health. If you hear something in this program that doesn't agree with what your doctor has told you, ask him or her about it.